Do you remember some of the phrases your dad said a lot when you were growing up? Every dad has these. It's part of the secret dad creed, but if you tell anyone, I'm afraid the consequences will be quite grave, so just keep this between us. One of the things I remember my dad saying a lot to me was, if you mess with the bull, you'll get the horns. Point, of course, is that if you pick a fight with something or someone bigger and stronger than you, there's a good chance you'll lose. I learned this the hard way on a few occasions. We had a family friend named Jerry who we saw every now and then, who was always kind of fun to mess with, but he wasn't much want to go easy on you just because you were a kid. One Christmas, the family was all gathered at his house, and I was being a bit bolder than wisdom would have suggested was prudent, and quickly found myself locked in a closet, beating on the door and screaming to be let out. Messing with the bull that night, I definitely got the horns. And although Jerry intended it for all to be in good fun, he was treating me like his enemy. And in that moment, I very playfully was, so it was only fair. That may have been a silly example of this, but more often than not, things are entirely more serious and go much worse for the people involved. For example, not long after King David had consolidated his rule over Israel, he heard about the death of a friend of his from his time on the run from King Saul. His friend was the king of the Ammonites, people who had a long and antagonistic relationship with the people of Israel. Still, the king had been a friend to him, so David sent some servants to express his condolences to Hanun, the king's son, who was now reigning in his place. Fortunately, Hanun had some advisors who remembered well the past tensions between the nations, and their advice to him was to treat David's servants not as a gracious word from a friend of his father, but as potential enemy spies, helping him to plot how to conquer the nation during the turmoil of a leadership transition. The result was, well, let me just read it to you, from 2 Samuel chapter 10. So Hanun took David's emissaries, shaved off half their beards, cut their clothes in half at the hips, and the Hebrew here doesn't use the word hips, and sent them away. Now the point here was not to injure the men, but to embarrass them. And indeed, having half a beard would look ridiculous enough, but walking around naked from the waist down in a very modest culture would have been exponentially worse, in order to send the message that Ammon was a very strong nation. And any attempt by David to interfere in their affairs would result in a similar embarrassment for the whole nation of Israel. What the king and his advisors did not realize, though, was that they were messing with a bull in David, and over the next few months, they got the horns in rather dramatic fashion. And yet, when it comes to behavior towards someone perceived as an enemy, what the king of Ammon did is far more common than a more restrained and measured approach. Now, we may not treat our perceived enemies in quite the same manner as Hanun did David's servants, but we nonetheless have ways of treating our enemies somewhat differently than our friends. Lisa and I had the wonderful chance to go to Hawaii for our anniversary a few years ago. And one of the first things we were told in getting ready for our trip was that everything over there costs a lot more, and it does. Now, we knew this going in, but the $26 pineapple we found, and didn't buy, at a farmer's market one morning left us thoroughly convinced of it. On our way over, though, we met a woman native to the island state who shared with us that locals with a Hawaiian ID were generally charged a lower price for pretty much everything than tourists were. Now, Hawaiians generally love tourists, as long as they do the tourist thing and go home after a few days, leaving lots of their money behind. But tourists aren't friends. We see this in other ways, too. Watch a basketball game sometime. Or maybe a football game. When one team scores and catches the ball, it's not uncommon for them, rather than handing the ball to the official or their opponents in order to inbound it and continue the game, to simply drop it on the floor. Or even give a little tap in the opposite direction. Or when the play finishes in a football game, the players will sometimes just kind of toss the ball. It's a small gesture, but it says, "You're not one of us." Even more personally than that, though, think about the last time you weren't happy with a friend or maybe even your spouse. Even if you didn't tell them with words how you were feeling, I suspect you let them know all the same through a series of nonverbal cues, crossed arms, rolled eyes, exasperated sighs, and so on and so forth. At the same time, I would wager your behavior towards someone with whom you were more enamored did not reflect similar contempt. The other person was hard to love in that moment, and you made sure they knew it. The fact is, we all have people in our lives who are hard to love. And even if that's usually only a temporary label for you, nonetheless, there are some people in your life right now who you have a hard time loving. There are people in the world around you, in the culture around you, who you have a hard time loving. We live in the midst of a culture today that is filled with people we are told by somebody are hard to love. There are the homeless people, criminals, and the addicts. There are pushers and users and people who work the system rather than working themselves. There are black people and brown people and yellow people and white people. There are Muslims and atheists and neo-pagans and Christians. There are Republicans, Democrats. There are poor people and rich people. There are hipsters and millennials. There are gun owners and hunters. There are the environmentalists and the animal rights activists and the vegans. There are the rednecks and the urbanites. There are people who don't know how to work the self-checkout machines at Lowe's or Walmart and yet keep getting in those lines anyway. They're the people who can't handle talking on their phone and driving at the same time, or the people who cross in front of your car in the parking lot without giving a courtesy wave. Well, hold on. That's kind of my own short list. I better go ahead and cut that short. Anyway, for all of us, we have a list of pretty standard go-tos when it comes to people we consider hard to love. But the reality is, that's a category which can easily hit a lot closer to home than some nameless face who's a member of a group we generally don't like for one reason or another. It may be that today, the most relevant hard-to-love person for you is your brother or sister. Could be a parent. Could be a child. Come on, parents. There are days when your kids are hard to love. In fact, maybe it's easier to detail out the days your kids aren't hard to love. Youth, you may face the same challenge with your parents. Could be a co-worker. Could be your spouse. Ladies, think about the last time your husband was hard to love. Not this morning, just before then. Right? Guys, same thing. Could even be a fellow member of the church body. The point is, if you limit your thinking about hard-to-love people to someone far away who you never actually interact with or maybe even lay eyes on, it's easy to forget that some of the hardest-to-love people in our lives are really the ones we encounter on a daily basis. The problem with forgetting this is that when we do, we don't ever work on it. And if we don't work on it, it doesn't get easier. When something stays hard very long without showing any signs of improving, eventually we stop trying. The problem, of course, is that when we switch from talking about some far-off person in some far-off place for whom our love is of little consequence to talking about one of these vital relationships that are part of the fabric of our everyday lives, there's far too much at stake for us to risk finding ourselves in such a place for long. With all of this in mind, this morning we are launching on a brand new teaching series called Hard to Love. It will take us from now through Thanksgiving. Along the way, we'll hear some powerful stories and wrestle with some hard truths that will point us to just how important loving hard to love people in our lives really is. And then as we get a little closer to Thanksgiving, we're going to make a turn together and face up to something that won't be easy. But once we do, we'll be able to approach the holiday that's really become more about gluttony and consumerism. Family and food. Right, family and food. Then its name would imply, with a bit stronger of a reason for gratitude than perhaps we've been able to do in perhaps quite some time. Not only will you not want to miss a single part of this series, but this is going to be a great time to bring folks you know who are struggling with loving someone important in their lives, who are perhaps struggling with the very idea of the gospel itself. But this morning, before we can go very far, we need to establish a baseline from which the rest of what we're going to talk about over the next few weeks can flow. Because of this, if when we get to the end of our time together this morning you feel like the story isn't finished yet, you will be correct. You have to keep coming back until you've heard the whole thing. I promise it will be worth your while. Now, this baseline is actually pretty simple to establish. It's just not very easy. It flows out of a bit of teaching from Jesus, which if you've been around the church for very long, you've probably heard. In fact, this idea is something Christians are generally known as believing, even if we aren't quite as consistently known for putting it into practice. The thing is, though, because of the influence of the gospel on our culture, while folks who have been around the church are pretty well programmed to think in these terms, again, even if we don't always put it into practice like we should, we forget that on the broader scale of human history, this kind of thinking and the behavior accompanying it are a pretty rare affair. Well, this bit of teaching came when Jesus was talking to the crowds pretty early on in his ministry. He was talking, taking some of the big themes and big ideas of his famous Sermon on the Mount on the road and making sure everybody had a chance to hear this powerful message. This particular instance happened on a wide plain with a huge crowd gathered. He started with some Beatitudes, which, while not quite as famous as their counterparts in the Sermon on the Mount, nonetheless pick up some of the same themes. This time, though, he went on to offer some woes or warnings to folks about some situations, attitudes, and behaviors that can make their lives more difficult than worldly wisdom would suggest they would. From here, then, Jesus moves from the personal to the interpersonal. And the way that he frames this suggests he's talking to more than just his followers in the crowd. He's offering some advice on wise living to anyone willing to give him the time of day. Grab a nearby copy of the scriptures, and you can take a look at this with me in Luke chapter 6, verse 27. Listen to what Jesus says here. "But I say to you who listen, love your enemies. Do what is good to those who hate you. Bless those who curse you. Pray for those who mistreat you." Ah, okay. The old love your enemies bit. You know, we've heard this before. We're supposed to love our enemies, blah, 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 blah. Let's really think about this for a minute. If you read this and use one of the many standard definitions of love common in our culture when it comes to what Jesus is saying here, it comes off sounding like absolute nonsense. I mean, think about it. Have amorous feelings for your enemies. Right. How about this? Think good thoughts about your enemies and leave them to pursue the desires of their heart without judging them. It's one of the ways we understand love today, isn't it? Well, if there are enemies, then the desires of their heart are probably not to our favor, so why on earth would we want to do that? Or maybe just even this, like your enemies. There are enemies, so kind of by definition, we don't like them, nor they us for that matter. See what I mean? Nonsense. Making any positive sense out of what Jesus says here in the next few verses then absolutely demands our coming at it assuming on the correct definition of love. Good thing we spent so much time talking about this a couple weeks ago. When we properly understand love as an intentional decision to see someone else become fully who God designed them to be, we all of a sudden find ourselves in a place in which we can start to wrap our brains around this. And indeed, the three explanatory examples Jesus immediately offers after making the initial pronouncement point clearly in this direction. If we are intentionally committed to seeing someone become fully who God designed them to be, then it doesn't matter if they hate us or curse us or even abuse us. We're still going to do good to them, bless them, and pray for them because we want to see them become who God designed them to be, not whoever it is we had in mind. Still, though, let's not make light of how rare this kind of thinking is. Simply put, people just don't do this. When someone curses us, we tend to curse them right back. We respond in kind and quickly. When someone hates us, we don't sit around thinking of ways we can serve them. At the very least, we ignore and otherwise stay away from them. At the most, we sit around thinking of ways we can cause them trouble. And when someone abuses us, we don't lie down and take it. We begin plotting our revenge. We may pray against them, but we certainly don't pray for them. And just because I know some of you are country music fans and have Jerron Lowenstein's old song, "I Pray For You," running through your head right now, his song is a nearly perfect example of how the world around us reacts to Jesus' words here. And there's a reason in the version of this sermon that Matthew recorded, Jesus said to the crowd, "You've heard that it was said, love your neighbor and hate your enemy." Because they had heard that. A lot. We still do today. When we have people in our lives who are hard to love, our first and most natural reaction is to give in to the difficulty and refuse to love them. What Jesus says next only serves to play into this tendency. And it does so by being really hard. Like I told you a few minutes ago, this baseline is really simple to understand, but simple should in no ways be construed as easy. Listen to this. If anyone hits you on the cheek, offer the other also. And if anyone takes away your coat, don't hold back your shirt either. Give to everyone who asks you, and from someone who takes your things, don't ask for them back. Can we all just go ahead and agree that that stuff sounds crazy? We need to show strength when we're wrong, right? If someone steals from us, we should do whatever it takes to get our stuff back and to make them pay for taking it in the first place. That's just common sense. And we can't be giving to every beggar we pass on the street. Poverty-finding experts of all stripes generally agree that's not a good idea. So what gives? Well, the first thing we need to note is that Jesus was talking to an audience made up of folks who lived 2,000 years ago and thought like it. Their cultural context resulted in them understanding these ideas somewhat differently from how we naturally do today. For example, there was no such thing as social welfare then, so giving to beggars was literally the only help they were ever going to receive. Theirs was also an honor-shame culture in which every gift came with the expectation of a return. The point here is that we need to work to understand what Jesus said through their eyes and ears before reacting to our initial assumptions about it. The second thing we need to note, though, is what Jesus said next. Look at this in verse 31. Just as you want others to do for you, do the same for them. This is, of course, the famous golden rule. Now, skeptics and critics of the faith like to point out that Jesus was not the first person to espouse this idea. A form of it exists in every other major world religion and philosophy, many predating Christianity by quite a long time. But Jesus was the first person to phrase it like this. For most folks, it went something like this. Don't do unto others what you don't want them to do to you. That's the lazy man's version. It's an improvement on the way most folks behave, which is do unto others whatever they do unto you. But if you think about it, all you need to do to live up to this principle is not be a jerk. Jesus' rephrasing of the idea turned the standard version on its head. He made it active and intentional. However it is you want other people to treat you, go ahead and treat them that way first. Or perhaps to paraphrase this idea with our theme in mind, if you want the hard to love people in your life to become less hard to love, try loving them. But if all of that was advice that's pretty good for anybody to follow, what comes next is much more specifically aimed at Jesus followers. If you're not a Jesus follower, you can actually just kind of sit back and relax now and laugh at how silly we all are here. But if you are, it's time to put on your big boy boots. Check this out back at the text in verse 32. If you love those who love you, what credit is that to you? Now, the rather obvious response here is, well, at least a little bit because they keep loving me. But Jesus has something more in mind for his followers than merely matching the standard thinking of the world around us. Stay with me here. Even sinners love those who love them. If you do what is good to those who are good to you, what credit is that to you? Even sinners do that. And if you lend to those from whom you expect to receive, what credit is that to you? Even sinners lend to sinners to be repaid in full. In other words, yes, everybody loves the people who love them. Hitler was kind to his friends. Kim Jong-il did good things for his son Kim Jong-un. There's honor among thieves. That's normal. But as followers of Jesus, we're not called to be normal. We're called to stand out. We're called to be something higher. When it comes to the hard to love people in our lives, people we might otherwise identify as our enemies, behaving like everyone else does is simply not an option for us. After all, who would want to be a part of a movement that will result in them being just like everybody else? I sure wouldn't. And you wouldn't either. If our behavior, even in our best moments, makes us indistinguishable from folks who neither have nor want anything to do with Jesus, why bother? That's why here at the end, Jesus lays out this baseline for us when it comes to the hard to love people in our lives. And he does it by going back to what he said earlier and then building a framework around that for followers of Jesus. Makes sense. Makes it not simply understandable, but essential. You ready for this? Look at verse 35 with me. But love your enemies. That is, love people in your life who are hard to love. And do good, do what is good and lend, expecting nothing in return. Then your reward will be great and you will be children of the Most High. And here's the crux of the thing. For he is gracious to the ungrateful and the evil. Let me put that last part in a little different way that we'll come back to in a few weeks. But God shows his love for us in that while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. Here is why we are to go above and beyond the world around us to show love to the hard-to-love people in our lives. God's already done the same thing for us. Think about it. You ever been ungrateful for the things God's done for you? You ever been hard to love for God? I mean, yeah, technically none of us has, because God is love and his love is entirely free from conditions, but that's exactly the point. Apart from God, we all live lives that are steeped in evil and supremely ungrateful. For the only proper display of gratitude to God for giving us life in the first place is to give our lives unrestrainedly back to him. And yet, he's still good to us. He's kind to us. He still works with great intentionality to see us become fully who he designed us to be. More simply, he loves us. And if the God who owes us nothing and yet gives us everything does so, has already done so, ought we not do the same for the hard-to-love folks in our own lives? In other words, we love hard-to-loves because God does too. Rather than making angry social media posts about your political opposites, pray for them. When your friends have let you down and turned you out, find ways to bless them. When your kids are jumping on your last nerve, and I'm preaching myself here, come on, serve them. Do good to them. When your parents are making you want to put your head through a wall, practice obedience and trust with them. When your spouse is the last person in the world you want to think about loving, let alone liking, you love her. You love him. And start finding ways to show it. You love your hard to loves because God does too. And if that's not clear enough, here are five more really practical ways to love the hard-to-loves in your life. First, mind your manners. It's amazing how doing something as simple as saying please and thank you can change both our attitude toward others as well as their attitude toward us. Second, remember what love is. Love is an intentional decision to see someone else become fully who God designed them to be. If you're going to love the hard-to-loves in your life, that's what you've got to do. That's what God does with us. Any other approach will fail you. Third, always respond to other people with kindness and never in kind. When someone lobs a barb at us, our first reaction is to throw one back, even if we only do it in our minds. What does that ever accomplish? Nothing. It only continues hostilities and keeps that hard-to-love barrier in place. When we respond with kindness, though, channels of love are opened, and the potential for blessing increases exponentially. Fourth, remember who you are and who they are. You both are current or former sinners who were loved by the God of all grace and truth. You are someone else's hard to love, and yet you are loved. Return the favor. Fifth and finally, keep Jesus' particular formulation of the golden rule well in mind. Imagine the good things you want other people to do for you, even from the people for whom you're hard to love. And then take the initiative to do them for the people around you. Take the lead, because that's exactly what God did for you, for us. Christ died in our place while we were still sinners. We love our hard to loves because God does too. Doesn't matter who it is. It doesn't matter what they've done. We love our hard-to-loves because God does too. And if you'll come back for the next couple of weeks, we'll take a look at this together and what this can accomplish.